Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
To Handy Link, sponsored by the Italian Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In this next segment of our show, we'll hear from Elizabeth Lyonsberry, who will be telling us a little bit about her experiences with polio. So tell me a little bit about your experiences with the work related to polio.
My experiences myself or of others?
A little of both.
Okay. I had polio when I was 8 years old. And it left me with wearing braces on both legs and several surgeries. And after being looked after and reaching adulthood, I thought that I had actually beat the polio and that it was a thing of the past for me. But sadly, I found out later, as have many, many other polio survivors, that this thing comes back to haunt you as you, about 30 years later, as you get a little older. I started noticing a lot of joint pain, a lot of weak muscles, and weak muscles and pain in the joints and muscles. I'm sorry to repeat myself there. Extreme fatigue. I would say it felt like someone put a big giant hypodermic needle in my body and just drew out the energy. And since in recent times I've learned to call that hitting the polio wall, because many, many other people that are polio survivors are experiencing this. There's sleep disturbances, which we all face. An intolerance to cold, and some of us also have intolerance to heat. Now, it took me 20 years or more to finally find out just what was happening. The doctors didn't know anything about it, and we were all told it's in your head. Me in particular, I was told you need to do more. Well, here I can interject that I was raising five children, teaching night school, and running a small business. So how I could do any more, I will never know. Then I received a newspaper clipping from a friend, and it described this phenomenon, post-polio syndrome. Little is known about it. And I read the article. It was written by a Margaret Curry in Ottawa. Margaret has since passed away. But that led me to hunt for a diagnosis, which I finally did get at West Park Post Polio Clinic, which has since been canceled, along with many of the rest of us, that I did have post polio syndrome. It did indeed exist. And there was a conference in Toronto sponsored by then Ontario March of Dimes, which is now March of Dimes Canada. It was called Polio Second Challenge, and this was all about post-polio. So this verified what I had come to find out for myself. And that's when I brought the information back to my doctor and when I started getting a bit of help.
So can you
can put anybody's name that had polio on my story pretty well.
So can you tell me a little bit about some of the coping strategies you used to deal with the chronic pain, the sleep loss?
Well, some of the strategies that I've learned to use is to recognize that the wall, I'm going to hit the wall before I do. Because if I lie down and rest for half an hour just before it comes on, I can sometimes beat it. If I don't, I'll have to lie down for an hour and a half to let it pass by. I've learned to use assistive devices. I think one of the bitterest pills I learned was to use a wheelchair and then a power wheelchair. But that wheelchair has become my closest friend. It allows me to do so much that I couldn't do otherwise. I did go back into braces for a while, which helped, but now it only makes things worse.
So, can you tell me, has there been any success in your dealing with the whole condition? Any way that you've really risen above it?
I think joining a support group was part of being the biggest assistance I had, because I was in a room with other people that knew exactly what I was talking about. And we could let our hair down, so to speak, and let it all hang out. It was a big relief. Then I started to attend conferences, and I attended one in St. Louis, Missouri, where I connected with Post Polio Health International. Their mission was education, advocacy, networking, and research. And I learned a lot at their conferences. I'm now sitting on their board of directors as we try to help people that are experiencing the new symptoms of polio so that they can avoid some of the miseries around post-polio syndrome. There are a couple of websites. I forgot to mention that I was involved with March of Dimes Canada, which used to be called Ontario March of Dimes, and we've now gone national. I sit on their board of directors also, and we have more or less the same mission as Post Polio Health International. We work mostly in Canada, but we do have support groups across the country, and that is, I think, the biggest thing that they have done for their people.
Like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Okay.
What Elizabeth was saying about hitting the wall and knowing you're going to get there, for a person with a disability, that comes down to responding to one's own needs. A person can know their own strength better than anyone else, but they have to know how to apply that. They have to know at what times they feel most physically capable. It's only human arrogance that says, just because I was able to take a few steps today, I'll be able to take a 12K run, for example. Fact is, a person can build into that kind of strength, but it's a matter of taking it at your own pace, knowing your own capabilities, your own limits. And once you've built into a place where you know you can handle something, and you respond to what you need, you will find strength to endure, create, and accomplish. But you have to figure polio, with all its effects, like any chronic disability, the pain it causes, the sleeplessness, that can seriously impact one's ability be educated, to work, to be in a productive environment. The fact is, that's where job accommodations really do play a role. It is an employer's duty to recognize that at times there may be things like chronic pain and whatnot, and make it possible for a person affected to be productive, to give a meaningful contribution. There always is a way. Simply a matter of people taking the time to understand and to recognize. This is one factor. If a person's body causes pain, that in no way inhibits the mind, which can do great things. Just because a person moves a little differently doesn't mean they can't think with the best of us. Doesn't mean they're not quick, sharp, and capable. But it's a matter of looking beyond the surface and beyond the obvious. In Elizabeth's story, she knew there was something that was just not right. And she did some investigating on her own by the sounds of it. That's what a person should do. Keep plugging away at it until you find an answer. And don't just accept the first word you're given as gospel. For the fact is, doctors are human just like the rest of us. And they don't necessarily know everything right off. Yes, the medical establishment does a fine job in many cases, but person should understand for themselves as well. When they're not at a doctor's office and they're having chronic pain, they should know something about how to respond to that condition. Find your own strength, find your own coping mechanisms. And when something is beyond you, go to a doctor, seek help. But don't just go on to any old sketchy website and read medical facts that may or may not be facts and may or may not be current. If it's reputable information, if it matches up with you, and if your doctor agrees, then yes, that may be the situation. As I've said many times, medical science is merely the baseline from which the individual draws some symptoms. For the fact is, no medical baseline can ever take into consideration the human strength. If there's a 0.5% chance of survival, somebody survived it somewhere. It's not likely, but the fact is, there's someone who's done it. Why? Because they knew they were responding to themselves. They let the human factor come into play. HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Since 1982, ArtSight Inc. has been a nonprofit, artists-run center dedicated to expanding the visibility of contemporary arts within our region. We are dedicated to advancing the professional presentation, promotion, and animation of contemporary art forms. Along with creating forums for critical dialogue, professional development, and cultural exchange, ArtSight presents guest artist lectures, workshops and residencies, film screenings, multidisciplinary performance events, and more. For more information about ArtSight and our upcoming events, visit artsight.ca.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from Elizabeth Lyonsberry, was telling us a little bit about her experiences with polio. In this segment of our show, we'll hear from Befier Perry, who will be telling us a little bit about the issues surrounding poverty and disability.
Okay.
So tell me a little bit about some of the issues surrounding poverty and disability.
Well, to begin with, I think a clear definition of disability needs to be established. So I think that's where I'll start. Usually disability is, understood as a physical limitation, a physical condition of the person, or mental, intellectual, or sensory. But in the literature, in research literature, there's actually a distinction made between the condition, which is referred to as an impairment, and disability. So the impairment, as I said, is the condition, and then the disability is the restriction faced by these by persons with impairments, which inhibits or hinders equal participation in society. So given the distinction between these two things, it has been proposed that there's actually a vicious cycle between poverty and disability. And then there's another researcher that speaks to these two coming out of society as interlocking circles, which we'd get into in a bit. But in terms of the vicious cycle, the vicious cycle is such that, you know, when you have an impairment, you're discriminated against, and then this leads to exclusion, which leads to poverty, which leads to chronic poverty, which leads to further exclusion, and then can actually lead to further impairment, right?
Yes.
Tom? Hi, excuse?
So I was going to ask, how do things like lack of access to services or malnutrition because there's no stable work to buy food, how do these things
so
play a role?
That's, okay. So given this cycle, you know, this being discriminated against comes in, like, different forms. It comes in terms of attitudes. It comes in terms of not having access to services such as health, education, employment, as well as not having access to, like, the physical infrastructure of a building. And all these impact, well, in one way or the other, on a person becoming poor, right? So, for example, children, when they're not able to attend regular schools, for example, or even if they're in a special school and receiving special education, which is actually, in some cases, and I can speak in the context of Trinidad and Tobago, it's like a limited part of the curriculum which is taught in regular schools. And because of this, they actually leave the school system with fewer qualifications, fewer skills, fewer and less knowledge. And this impacts on their ability to actually get a job, and the opportunities that they are left with in terms of employment is actually lessened. And when you're in a situation like this, of course, you know, you're unable, so they're unable to get a job. When you're growing up now, they're unable to get a job. And when you're in a situation like this, you know, you're unable to provide for yourself and meet your basic needs in terms of food and shelter and whatnot. And it's actually something that is seen from country to country. If you look at the literature, you see it in different countries. And well, I can speak to my country, you know, and interacting with patients with impairments here, you know, the basic needs are not met in terms of, you know, having enough food to eat, really, not being able to pay rent and the like, yeah.
So what sorts of steps are being taken to alleviate these inequities?
Right. So what happens, what usually happens, well, there's two sides to it, right? When government has now trying to, you know, include children with disabilities in the school system and, you know, provide for them within that system. I know that inclusion within the school system is different from country to country. I know in some cases, you know, inclusion is working very well, but in other countries, you know, it's not as effective because enough studies are not being done into how to include these various impairment types into the school system, and you know how to, like, modify lesson plans and whatnot to, you know, include this wide range of learning abilities. In terms of employment, I know, well, in some cases, I know they're trying to employ persons with disabilities, and I know of the DRPI who's working to help bridge the gap between, you know, employee skills and what the employer can offer. So things are being done, but I think it's a country-to-country basis. I can't say that, you know, say something and say that this is happening globally, because in the context in context of a country, it would be different.
So if you could send any one message about what needs to happen in terms of leveling the playing field for persons mm-hmm. with disabilities, what might you say?
Well, I would say, first of all, you need to speak to persons with disabilities or persons with impairments and find out what they need. I think a lot of times, you know, when the government come up with some sort of intervention, it is without discussion with persons who actually would know what they need. And I think this would be the first step, I think, to having the proper infrastructure and services in place to, you know, level the playing field, as you said, for persons with impairments in different countries. What I would also add to that is that, you know, when you're making provisions for someone, it's what happens usually is that, you know, the government see these people as lacking something or they need help. And what they fail to realize is that persons with impairments are just like persons without impairments, you know. And I think that needs to be the underlying texture of policies and stuff, that whatever is being done, it's not so much that you give them help or you just do something to, you know, keep them quiet. It is something that, you know, really brings them out of the situation that they're in. And you know, you these policies should reflect equality and the rights that each one of us has.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
All right, not a problem. Thank you very much for having me.
Of course. Poverty and disability, my friends. I don't think there's a simple answer, in so much as we're creating all of these barriers in society. We're denying ourselves a workforce, in many cases, that can and would stimulate the economy. A few years ago, I had the privilege of interviewing a man named Mark Wafer, who owns a chain of Tim Hortons franchises. A substantial number of his employees have disabilities. The fact is, people respond well going in and seeing these people. They don't want the same old workforce churned out over and over again. They want to see different types of people in the world. And for those with disabilities living in poverty, they tend to build up this illusion, I think, in so much as they don't have a lot to work with. They get to this place of complacency where they say, this is all life can be for me. There's nothing better. And there might even be a hesitation to go out there and try for that job, try for that thing that'll better your life. Now, a person with a disability is no less entitled to that than anyone else, but the hesitation comes in when all you've known is just difficulty, impoverished conditions. But really, we all deserve that step up. How can we expect a person with a disability to want to be a part of the workforce, to want to accept meaningful, gainful work, employment, community inclusion, if all they've ever known is the idea that, yeah, they'll toss us a turkey bone because they feel they have to? No. A person with a disability has their own merits, and they can and should be able to stand for those. They should be able to say, I have a voice that counts. Listen to what I have to say. Listen to what I need. And know that I speak from a place of intelligence and experience. Understand that I want what anyone wants. To live, to love, to be loved, to contribute something to this world, to follow my heart. It's a difficult thing in this day and age. We come from the want it now, want it fast, want it cheap generation. We expect that simply because we say that we're inclusive, magically we're going to be inclusive. No. Establishing this does take a lot of work. But I guarantee you, my friends, it's the most worthwhile thing you can imagine. A few weeks ago, our good friend John Brown talked about how a young man in Bolivia is hopefully going to receive a prosthetic leg so he can be a part of his community again. I can't imagine a better Christmas gift. Not just the limb itself, but the idea that someone cared enough to say, you have value in this world. And no matter what kind of circumstances you're living in, I'm not going to marginalize or underestimate your potential. It's not my place. It's not my right. No. Especially this time of year, you see people coming together to really make it count for their fellow human beings, to try and lift others out of poverty, to try to just be a positive voice of support. My question is, if it's so wonderful to live this way, that the world can come together and spread the light, why can't we do it all the time? Why can't we see the person who needs help getting through the door and actually help them? Why can't we see the need of a person with a disability, no matter where they are, and say, you're entitled to rights and protections the same as anyone else? It is no one's place to tear down the value of another's life. It's not fair, it's not right, and eventually you build a wall so high, nobody gets over. Standing for a person with a disability is not an obligation. It's a privilege. It's the chance to be a part of something. That someday, when they accomplish whatever it is they're going to, that you can safely say, I was a part of your road. I was a part of the story that showed you you're a greater person than you ever realized. That your capabilities are not limited by the physical, the mental, or anything else. They are limited by who and what you are alone. And the truth is, it's this time of year that a lot of smaller disability organizations, even the bigger ones too, they do a lot of fundraising and a lot of charitable outreach. Why? Because they're needed. Regardless of whether they have one person running the office or 1,000, they need to exist. They need to be that voice for a person with a disability. And really, this is the time of year we as a species come together. Can't we include all the people, regardless of how they move, look, think, or what have you, regardless of whether they have $1,000,000 or would have to save up just to have $1. We are all human, and we are all a gift. And this is the time of year, my friends, where we must look beyond a person's financial circumstances, physical circumstances, mental circumstances, to just embrace one another. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.